We know adolescents take risks, so when it comes to steering them in the right direction, it might surprise you to think that they don't think they are invincible. And in fact, giving them more and more statistics about how at risk they are won't help them at all. Contrary to popular belief, adolescents largely tend to overestimate their risk. And something else that may surprise you is that they feel actual pain if they feel socially excluded. Our guest, Dr. Jess Shatkin, has been doing groundbreaking research in this area for around 15 years. He's a physician and child, adolescent and adult psychiatrist, also founder and director of one of the United States' largest training programs in psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine. He's the author of Born to be Wild, Why Teens Take Risks and How We Can Keep Them Safe. Jess says when young people take risks, it's important to understand they aren't just doing it to get on your nerves.
The most important point is that we have empathy for these kids and we realize that so much of what they do that gets them into trouble, that gets them engaged in risk, is not something they're doing personally to spite their parents or the adults in their lives. They're not doing it necessarily just on a whim. They're actually doing it for very purposeful evolutionary biology reasons. They have been driven and designed by eons of evolution to take risk during adolescence, and that's exactly what this period of time of life is about. And it may be that in 2020, it makes less sense for them to be doing many of these things, but historically, evolutionarily, we progress a lot more slowly than we do in terms of society and culture. So we still have those genes and those tendencies and those hormones that are directing us into outrageous, often risk-taking behavior that, from a species point of view, makes perfect sense.
So what is the young person themselves experiencing? We can all think of the phrase, what was he thinking?
What the hell were you thinking?
You know, exactly. What was going on in her head? What was going on? What is going on?
Yeah.
When the natural drives and the evolutionary drives are happening, what is going on in the head?
Right. So there is some degree of impulsivity that we settle or it calms down as we age. So to some degree, there's a little bit of impulsivity, sure, that young people have, that older people have tempered by the time they reach adulthood. But more than that, there's a bunch of neurochemical and anatomical things going on that most people are unaware of. For example, we have higher levels of dopamine in our brain during adolescence than we had before we were adolescents and then we will have after adolescence. And by adolescence, I want to be clear, I'm really talking about 11, 12, 13 to about 26, 27 years of age, much longer than we used to understand because now we understand the brain is undergoing major changes during those years, which makes these young people so interesting to work with and focus on. So dopamine's higher than it's ever been and ever will be. And dopamine, many people associate with addiction. They associate it with pleasure. But what dopamine really is a neurochemical that teaches us things. It's a learning neurochemical. And it's not about pleasure as much as the promise of pleasure. So I'll give you an example. The first time you tried a piece of chocolate, let's say you were a child and your mother or father said, try this, you'll like it, and you tried it, and it wasn't a good experience. It was an outrageously good experience. It was incredible. And your dopamine went up, and your body said, ah, this is important for survival. I need to remember this. This tasted so good. This triggered so many good feelings in my body. Same thing when you first had a piece of food that you like of another sort, or the first time you had sex, or the first time you try cocaine, whatever it is, those things, particularly drugs of abuse, increase the dopamine many, many, many times over what a natural reinforcer like a good conversation or a piece of chocolate does. And so every time now that you get near that desired object, that chocolate, or if you're involved in using drugs of abuse, then towards those drugs, your dopamine starts to seep out. And it seeps out in very high levels to drive you towards that behavior because that behavior is thought to be important for survival. When young people learn, when children learn that in order to have a baby, you have to have intercourse, many of them are turned off and can't believe the adult who's telling them this crazy story. But the fact is, a few years later, after puberty, they're drawn to doing that at a level they could have never imagined. And the idea of the act itself is really quite strange. But dopamine tells us this is good, this is important. And so we're being led around a bit by evolutionary biology towards behaviors that feel good, that seem like they're important for survival. Some are, and some aren't. And Mother Nature has built us as a species to engage in lots of behaviors that are not necessarily good for the individual, but that are good for the species. So during adolescence, we are stronger, we are faster, we have a better immune response, we can tolerate pain and temperature extremes better. That's why the adolescents go off in the military. That's why we put them there then, because they are best built for that activity. Just like hundreds of thousands of years ago, they were built for running over the hill and finding new mates or finding new water and food sources. Yeah, some thousands of them will die, but our species will live on because some of them will find a food that's edible, some will find water that's potable, some will find a mate with whom they can have children, and they will live on. And if you stay in the cave, you're not going
to
grow.
So to my question, what were they thinking? Do they think after the event and reflect and assess, or are they just quickly on to the next, speaking very generally, very stereotypically, are they just generally typically already on to the next event? Is there a process of evaluation?
Of course there is.
And how long does it last, and how important is it?
Well, something you might be surprised to know, and most parents are, is that kids don't think that they're invincible. They believe, in fact, that they're vincible, that they're actually much more likely to get hurt by some of these things they do, or to get pregnant, or to get a sexually transmitted infection, or to have an automobile accident, or to die even, much, much more likely, many thousands of times more likely, they imagine themselves to be than they actually are. But that doesn't stop them, because all these other things are driving them. So sure, they believe from the very beginning that the risk of pregnancy or the risk of getting into an accident is very, very high. But that doesn't stop them because they're being driven by their biology. In fact, adults also overestimate things. But adults don't do these things because we all also have optimistic bias. We also, all of us think a little bit that maybe it's not going to happen to us, it'll happen to someone else. But adults even are more optimistic than young people. So young people, for example, a beautiful study of 15-year-olds in the United States looking at thousands of kids shows that they think the risk of dying this year is about 200 times higher than it is. They think the risk of developing HIV is about 60,000 times higher than it actually is. But that doesn't stop them from engaging these behaviors. So they think about it. They overthink it, in fact. They overanalyze. And this is one of the reasons they run into trouble. We have to help them to break it down and to plan their behavior before they actually get in the situation, which is why it's so important for us to talk about this with them so they can think about how they're going to act when their friends are jumping off the bridge into the water, when their friends are smoking weed and driving. We have to plan it in advance what they're going to do.
What are the implications of this for how we approach working and dealing with young people and risk? Because, as you mentioned, they actually overestimate it. They overestimate risk. And despite that, participate for the reasons that you've talked about. So if you are looking to help them navigate what their body and brain is doing, what is it that we need most to understand, or perhaps, again, most misunderstand?
Yeah. So there are dozens of strategies which are worthwhile talking about. But in short, first, I want parents and the adults in kids' lives to understand that it's not personal, that a lot of what they're doing, most of what they're doing when it comes to risk, is not trying to show mom and dad up or to just be oppositional. A lot of this is driven by impulse, by biology. It's not only dopamine, it's other hormones as well, which I can talk about, which are driving them towards coupling off and engaging. So first we have to understand them and say, okay, I'm not going to take it personally. So now I can work with you on this. A, I want to teach these kids about their own neurobiology. Secondly, I want to put into practice many things that can help kids to function better, like, for example, later school start times for high school kids. Because if you start school later, they get more sleep. They don't just stay up later. They go to bed on their rhythm, and then they wake up a little bit later. They're more refreshed. They make better decisions. We have so much data looking at school grades, school absenteeism, automobile accidents, special college aptitude testing scores. All of this gets much better when we start school an hour or two behind the typical start times. We have exercise. In America, at least in the U.S., we've really done away with regular exercise in most schools most days of the week. They might get an hour or a half hour a few times a week. But we know that exercise not only improves your thinking, your memory, and your attention, but it also treats mild and moderate depression, clinical depression, as well as medicine and psychotherapy. So some of this is common common sense and some of the old things that we've gotten away from. But I want parents to understand it's not personal, and then I want them to have a whole plethora of strategies, things they can do at home and things the school and society can do to help them.
Does this mean zero tolerance is out for a start?
Zero tolerance was never good. And zero tolerance, which meant essentially if you make one infraction at school, like you hit somebody or you, blow off a firecracker at school or something like that, you get put into another school or you get expelled. That didn't help any single person. Everybody was harmed by that. Likewise, DARE, the Drug Abuse Resistance Education Program, in most iterations, it's worldwide, most funded health promotion program for teenagers ever, in most cases has not been good and in many cases has harmed the very kids they intended to help.
It's just the just say no approach.
Just say no, scared straight. A lot of these approaches were built on the impetus of goodwill, good thinking, the idea that this might work. But what happened was these interventions were not based on the science of understanding young people. It wasn't based on understanding how their brains work, how their bodies work. It was based on an older person, an adult saying, this should help. And that's not how we develop good science. We develop good science by going to the source, figuring out how they learn, how they think, and how they develop, and then working with them to figure it out.
So what are the strategies that can work? If the impulse is there or the knowledge is there, but I'm going to do it anyway, what sort of strategies are shown to be effective in helping them manage, the greatest risk, the one that's going to end their life?
Right. So here's a couple of things. First of all, it's parenting. And we know so much about parenting now. And parenting starts from the very earliest of ages. Think about, you get trained to drive a car, but you don't get trained to be a parent. And we know that a program called Behavioral Parent Training or Parent Management Training gives parents the core skills that they need in order to be effective parents. And that starts, again, at the very earliest of ages. And when parents have learned these skills, which we can teach in school, which we can teach at the pediatrician's office, which we can teach in maternal child health units, that these kids end up being adults who have many, many better outcomes, better grades, better health parameters, better mental health parameters, more money as they age, better jobs as they age, more likely to stay married. So many good things happen. So I think that we need to start at the very beginning with behavior modification and teaching young people how to parent. So that's one thing. Secondly, for parents who are already in the game, they need to learn these skills and also monitor their kids. And I don't mean they need to shackle them to the home or be a helicopter parent. I'm not advocating that. Kids need to take some risks, but they need to take safe risks. They need to be given a sort of a leash that goes back and forth and comes in and out like a bungee cord, depending on how much they have earned their independence and their freedoms. But parents need to be paying attention. Parents who pay attention and who talk to their kids about risk and who spend time with them have kids who listen to the parents and kids who actually ask the parents for advice and questions. There's no end of advice our kids can get from television and radio and computer and everywhere else, but it's from the parents that they'll get their best advice. So seeking out your parents and the parents seeking out the kids, really, and making sure they have some dead time just to talk to them and be with them, like family dinners and those kinds of things, make a big difference. We call it monitoring or being there or being a watchful parent. And those things make a huge difference. Some of the things I talked about around exercise, nutrition, and sleep, hugely important. So many problems we run into with risk-taking because our kids aren't sleeping enough. They're not getting exercise. We have in America, 35% of our children under the age of 18 are either overweight, which is 85th to 94th percentile, or obese, which is 95th and up. We have a huge problem there, and that affects your self-esteem. And what you're learning to do during adolescence that matters so much is to develop your self-efficacy, your belief in yourself, your ability to believe that you can actually make change in this world, in your life and in others, and to learn to regulate your emotions. So there's a lot we can teach our kids around that. Very scientifically valid tools that we can use to teach them how to communicate, how to have better relationships, and how to manage anxiety and upset mood. So those are some of the highlights, but there's many other things too, and these are strategies.
Is self-regulation a key? Number one, is the self-regulation a key? But number two, do you need specific strategies? Like if you go into this situation, and then, for example, you make the point that teenagers are actually very skilled drivers, and who's surprised by that? We can see what they can do with, a joystick or a computer mouse.
Right, right.
But the emotional brain takes over, and that's when the risk is elevated and something unthinkable happens in a vehicle. So it was a big part of that parenting that you're talking about and the conversation that you're talking about having a plan. If so-and-so suggests this, if this situation's about to unfold, what are you going to do?
Yes, and we want those conversations to happen, not in the moment of hot emotions. We want that to happen at a cool time, when you're sitting around at home, around the dinner table, talking about the party that's going to happen on Friday night. And, you know, a simple strategy might be, listen, you're going to go to the party. We know that there's going to be drinking. And your child might say, oh, there's not going to be drinking. There's not going to be any weed. And a savvy parent will say, well, it's very likely that somebody will be using, and I hope that you won't use. But I want you to know that if for some reason you decide to use, I want you to call me. I don't want you to get behind the wheel of the car. And we will talk tomorrow about what happened, but I do not want to see you behind that car, because if you do, there'll be big consequences to pay. And there'll be consequences for you know, getting out of hand, even if you call me, but it'll be much less so than otherwise, if that's the ethos of the family, depending on how they function, how old the kids are, and so forth. And it may be even beyond that. It may be you don't want to use. How do you want to talk about that? Let's role play how you're going to handle it when someone hands you a beer or hands you a joint if you don't want to smoke weed. Or let's role play how you say no after one drink. How do you manage that? The problem is that we sort of have these laws in our society where we say, okay, you can't drink till you're 18 or 21 or whatever it is, and then there's no training. People don't learn how to manage those situations. And we actually have a lot of skill in how to help people handle those situations and train for it. And our efforts in schools have been really much more puritanical and not more practical. And I think we need to move into a more practical domain.
Accidents and suicide are the leading causes of death among adolescents. They are a much greater cause of death than the next seven causes. So again, we are talking about an age and stage, an emotional age and stage. What is the link with the adolescent brain and this particular vulnerability?
Yeah, so there's a number of things. One is that most mental illness, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, ADHD, Tourette's, autism, etc., OCD, these things really start to blossom in childhood and early adolescence. In the best studies we have in the United States, it shows that adults with chronic mental illness first had significant and impairing symptoms most often before the age of 24, and half had them before the age of 14 years. So these things come on very, very early. So first, we need to be watching and be careful with kids and identify things early, because when we identify these problems early, we have so many good treatments, psychotherapeutic treatments, social and academic treatments, and medications that can be really helpful for our kids and can help them to moderate these difficulties. These disorders often make our kids more impulsive because they are not able to think through things quite as easily, or their thinking can be disturbed, or their emotions can be disturbed. And so they do things that are more impulsive or more driven by the desire to impress their peers than another child might have, or the desire to eliminate some emotional pain they're feeling, which might be stronger than others have. So the first thing is being really sensitive and looking at kids closely. You know, we do physical examinations in the United States as a standard every year for kids growing up. They go to a family doctor or a pediatrician. We do nothing for mental health, yet mental health affects just about everybody. By the time, you know, we make it to the grave, just about every one of us has had a major psychiatric disorder. And in the United States, 50% of teenagers have had a major psychiatric disorder, and 27 or 28% have had a severe disorder, like some of those ones I was talking about, that really get in the way of their functioning. So I think we need school-based clinics, because that's where our kids work and live, and so they need to be identified there and treated. And we need to be doing some evaluations and checks of everybody and targeting those kids who are at risk.
How does all of this physiological reality and emotional reality and chemical reality affect teens' social attachment systems, which have changed so much in the age of social media as well, even the way they conduct their relationships with their peers in particular?
Yeah.
What does parents need to understand about the intensity they can feel, or what might appear to the adult, and the irrationality of what they can think and feel in certain situations?
So think about this for a minute. Think about the most painful experience you've ever had in your life. And most people, when you ask them that question, 95% of people will choose something emotional, not something physical, not a car accident. If it's a car accident, it's usually because someone else they cared about got injured, or they got injured and it's not the pain of the injury, but it's the fact that they can't play cricket anymore or they can't play soccer anymore. It's the fact that their grandmother died who they love so much, or their parents got divorced when they were young. These things hurt us a great deal, and the brain is very efficient. It's only 3 pounds of neurons controlling a whole big body. And so the brain has had to double up systems. So there's only one pain mechanism in the brain, and that is the mechanism that manages physical and emotional pain. And so kids will do a lot to avoid emotional pain. You talk about screens, you talk about phones, you talk about social media. Well, what we've done is we've given kids a way to feel hurt all the time, FOMO, the fear of missing out, by showing them on Snapchat or Instagram or Facebook what party they didn't get invited to, who's having more fun than them, who's flirting more effectively than them, who's better looking than them or has better clothes or better hair or God knows what they imagine. And so we're constantly giving our kids through these devices a way to feel bad about themselves. And the more pain they feel, it's not just, you know, that emotional pain is very potent. And our kids, like our adults, will do a lot to avoid pain. Some will replace that physical pain, or that emotional pain with physical pain by cutting themselves or engaging in self-injurious behavior in another way. Some will try to avoid that emotional pain by taking drugs or by, you know, getting drunk or by seeking thrills. They'll do all sorts of things because that pain hurts so badly. The pain is so real, emotional pain is so real, that if you take kids who have been excluded from something, like not invited to a party, or they've had a breakup with a relationship, and you give them some acetaminophen or paracetamol or some ibuprofen, they'll feel better emotionally because it's the same pain system.
Are they as resilient as they need to be? Are they as resilient as previous generations have been? And I'm wary of even raising the intergenerational thing, but there is this perception that we seem to have an epidemic almost of anxiety among the current generation of young people, teens and 20s. And is that because of the complexity of their lives, or is it, and particularly those social relationships, or have we got something wrong when it comes to developing a healthy resilience and ability to get through that pain or just sit with that pain?
Yeah, I think you raise a really good series of questions. And I think you're right in that it may not help us to compare this generation to past, because that leads us to blaming them, thinking that they either we've done something wrong in our raising of them, so we're, you know, uncomfortable with ourselves, or they haven't stood up to the task and been the kind of kids that we intended them to be. It's hard to know. I think that there's a lot of supposition that the baby boomers raised their kids as they reflected the baby boomers on their own childhood and said, you know, my parents kind of made me do more for myself, and that wasn't always easy, and I wish I would have had some more vacations. I wish I would have had some more fun times. I wish I would have had a little less work, felt a little better about myself. So I'm going to make it easier on my kids. And I think a lot of us in the middle class and wealthier socioeconomic strata have felt that they could make it easier on their kids, and they have. And that may have contributed to some differences in resilience, because you don't have to, you know, do as much for yourself. And I could tell my own stories, and you could probably tell yours about paying for your own vacations or paying for your own college or whatever it was. And those things are meaningful and they make a difference. But there's also stressors that our kids are facing that we never had to deal with. And we just talked about, you know, the phone and social media. Constantly being bombarded with the fact that you may not be living up to what other people are getting and what other people are experiencing, and that you're being left behind. Remember that evolutionarily, our job as adolescents is to find a safe place to live, to get a good nest, and to find a mate. And so as we are always driven that way neurobiologically through a few of the neurochemicals we talked about and many others that I can talk about, that this drive towards being a popular person, a person who is desired and sought after, pushes us so hard, the more we're reminded that we may not be making muster, we may not be getting to the point of that, the worse we can feel about ourselves. So we may have made them a little bit less resilient. We've also given them a huge amount of toxin through social media, through all the television and all the movies that we're constantly being exposed to. Our kids are seeing so much information that generations prior didn't see. And having information is good, but you know, when you're 13 or 14, you're not quite ready to take on the massive information that kids are getting these days. And your ability to abstract and think about your place in the world is not what it will be 5 years later, 10 years later. So it's kind of overwhelming for a lot of our kids who don't have support and families and schools to shepherd them through it. So yes, they're probably a little less resilient in some ways, and we've really thrown so much at them, it's hard to know that how they could be more resilient.
There is a slight anomaly, it seems, in all this, and that we are also hearing, in this country at least, and I think around the Western world, that this is a risk-averse generation. They're learning to drive very late, if at all, many kids. They're having sex later, we are told. And many of them are shunning alcohol or starting to drink alcohol later. I'm not saying these are earth-shattering shifts in the numbers, but there appears to be something of a trend. Can you comment?
Yeah, I think that there is, and this is just something over the last couple of years we're starting to see some of, and it's not universal. You can look in certain places and you don't see this kind of shift. But I think that to some degree kids are appreciating and liking being kids because they feel cared for. They've got somebody who's going to manage them and monitor them and who's not going to have expectations of them in the same way as maybe prior generations' parents did. And so they don't mind moving home after college or staying at home while they go to college because someone will do their laundry and cook for them. And the drive to go out and do it for yourself may be a little bit lessened because the message parents have gotten is, well, it takes longer to develop, which is true. So the kids can have a little more comfort and a little more support, which is fine. But there's a misinterpretation there to some degree. We should never, in parentheses, be doing things for our kids that our kids can do for themselves because they need to learn how to do them. And that's what becoming an adult is all about. And the more we take responsibility, the more we learn to hold responsibility. So we shouldn't be waiting till our kids are 30 or 26 to just give them then responsibility, like we shouldn't wait till 25 or 21 to just all of a sudden give them alcohol. They need to be taught these things and to hold responsibility bit by bit with a parent and a society that's watching and is caretaking. The fact that kids are taking longer to drink, that they're holding on to their desire to have sex for a while, it's because I think that they don't feel that they're going to be adults if they do those things anyway, and nothing's pushing them for it. So I think there's a balance here.
Jess Shatkin, Dr. Jess Shatkin, physician, child, adolescent and adult psychiatrist, founder and director of one of the US's largest training programs in psychiatry at the New York University School of Medicine, and also the author of Born to be Wild, Why Teens Take Risks and How We Can Help Them Keep Safe.